The Daily Buzz on KCPW is sponsored in part by Sabra Hummus. Inspired by flavors from around the globe, Sabra's dips are handmade from fresh ingredients and spices. Sabra's mission is to bring healthy Middle Eastern cuisine to people's everyday diets. Online at sabra.com. The Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival is sponsored in part by Soyombo Mongolian Vodka, crafted in small batches at the original distillery site of the last emperor's palace in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Online at mongolianvodkas.com/soyombo.
It's the Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, Day 8. Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main. Coming up on today's show, Stuart Murdoch will be here. You may know him from Belle and Sebastian. He has a new movie called God Help the Girl. We'll also talk with the filmmakers of Appropriate Behavior, The Case Against 8, Song 1, Copenhagen, which is playing in Slamdance, as well as Kara Mertes from the Ford Foundation. That's all coming right up on The Daily Buzz from Sundance 2014, right after the news. As we continue on The Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. We're here on Main Street at the Chase Sapphire Lounge. Our daily program here at Sundance 2014, looking at the films and all of the buzz happening at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, presented by the Film Society of Lincoln Center with our producer Irene Cho. The show is supported by Soyombo Vodka. Talking about a new film that's playing at Sundance, God Help the Girl. Sitting across from me is the director of the film, Stuart Murdoch. Welcome.
Good morning. Hi.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah. I certainly am familiar with your work, and I think many of those who are listening in will be familiar with your work with a band called Belle and Sebastian. And I was excited to be in the theater a couple of days ago to actually see your work on screen or your work directing a film. Congratulations on that, first of all.
Thanks.
And it incorporates music that your band and that you have created. My understanding is that the album came first. Someone was describing to me, and I was reading a little bit about how the project sort of came to be, and I guess it was the album first, and then the film sort of grew from that. Am I correct, or can you explain that?
Yeah, I can explain. Actually, the songs and the script actually came very close together.
Okay.
The songs led the way, and then that I realized that I should try and write a script around the songs. The reason, though, that the album came out beforehand was because I felt that the songs were ready to record. Mm-hmm. And also, if there was a chance of making the film, I didn't want to make an album at the same time as making a film, because that would be a train wreck. so the record sneaked out first.
Why did you you just said a moment ago that you felt that you wanted to write a script from the music, or the songs sort of inspired a script, I guess is what you're saying.
Sure.
But why? Where did that seed
come to be quite frank, when the seed came along, which was the first song, the title song, God Help the Girl, which just arrived in my head like switching on a radio, very quickly afterwards I realized it was a character singing the song, and that she, you know, she would have a story. And a few weeks later, the film idea started coming from that. So I really didn't have a choice in the matter.
Have you found that with other music that you've created? Have you found that your work in music has inspired a narrative?
Never in such a specific way. Sure, never like this. Never like this, or else I would have made a film probably before this. This certainly took me down a different path. I've dabbled in it. Obviously, this earlier songs have been narrative. They've been little snapshots.
Right.
But, you know, a song is a much easier and less exhausting thing to take on, you know, than a film.
It's interesting for me to think about the fact that you followed your instinct in that way. You said just a moment ago that had you been so inspired, you would have just made a film previously.
Yeah.
As an artist, to what extent is it challenging, or maybe it's easy, to simply follow that instinct when you feel called to make a film, to then figure out how to make a film?
Well, if you don't follow your instincts, what do you have? And I'm not just talking about people who call themselves artists. I just mean in life, you know. If you don't listen to the little man, yeah, you will be lost. I'm lucky enough to be in a situation where the band lets me be free on a daily basis. So, yeah.
Let's talk about God Help the Girl. Let's talk about the narrative that grew from this music. Tell me about this character of Eve. Do you remember when you started to create this character and sort of started to formulate in your mind?
Sure. Like I said, there was one song came along, then two songs. Maybe by about the third song, I realized that it was very specifically a character that was singing these songs. Okay. I remember this might sound quite whimsical, but I actually had a dream where I was on stage with Belle and Sebastian. Other people in bands might empathize with this. I had forgotten all the words to the songs. My hands were turning into like sort of jellyfish or something. I couldn't do anything. But I was still having a good time, you know. The rest of the band were looking at me like they were really angry. But I heard somebody from the audience shout out, saying, I want to sing. And this person came on the stage in my dream and sang. And she sang amazing. And to an extent, that was Eve. That was her. And that just went on to, you know, to help with the character development.
I've seen your band play once in New York many years ago. And my memory of that experience is that there were a lot of people on stage.
A lot of people on stage to be angry at you. Yeah.
So at the very least, if that's ever happened to you, or if ever should it happen where you simply forget the words or can't sing, there's certainly a number of people around you to sort of pick up. And I imagine your fans are passionate enough that maybe they've attempted to, or maybe you have brought them on stage to sing along with you or sing along with the band on occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big help.
So let's talk about the filmmaking process. In what ways was it challenging, rewarding? What did you sort of learn from the process? What surprised you about the process of making a movie?
The most surprising thing was my producer, Barry Mendel, warned me at an early stage that the most important thing about making a film is the casting. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. I just thought he was saying this was his daily mantra or something. But in fact, that's the most surprising thing. A film like this, the most important thing is the casting. Mm-hmm. We almost spent about a year and a half or something casting the film, and that was quite an experience. We looked at 1,500 people for the part of Eve.
Wow.
Including online editions from open editions. But we looked at them all.
How did you know that Emily Browning, is that her name?
Yes.
How did you know that she was Eve? How did you know that, if you've looked at so many people for that role?
Yes, it wasn't. With Ollie, for instance, who plays James, it was an instant thing.
Ollie Alexander.
Ollie Alexander, yeah. I knew we had our man. As soon as I saw him, he sent in a funny video of everybody else auditioned. Usually they did a cover version, you know, everybody had to sing. But Ollie came on the screen and he said, behind a piano, he said, I'm just going to play you one of my own songs. This is one of my own compositions. And I had a feeling, okay, we've got our guy. But with Eve, it was a much trickier thing. She just had to have all these skills. You know, she had to be the rock upon which the film was based. And so it was a pretty exhaustive search. And actually, we sort of passed on Emily. It was 6 months between the time we saw her first edition, and then we went back and thought, actually, we need to look at her again and get her to do more stuff. Mm-hmm. And she got the role. Although I met a lot of people, she got the role without me actually meeting her.
Wow.
We did them over Skype, and we just had kind of long conversations, and you know, she's such an old soul, and she's been working, although she's young, she's been working in film for quite a while. And for a first-time director, to have somebody so solid, mm-hmm. is a great advantage.
Tell me about your work then, once you've cast these two actors. Tell me about your work as a director in shaping their on-screen relationship, shaping their performances. Tell me about the relationship that you had yeah. with them on set.
Well, that's the one bit that I was confident about.
You were.
You know all the other bits in directing, like telling people where to go and telling the guy what lens to use and what lights to use, and all that stuff's hard. And I'm hardly qualified to do it even. I got through it yeah. with good help. But the bit that I knew I was okay with was guiding the actors, because I'd written the script and I'd been with them, and I felt that the characters, I carried those characters around on my shoulder for so long, you know, just they were with me for so long that I knew exactly how I wanted them to be. But the great bonus we had was that when the three of them, the gang, came together as people, as real people, they immediately had a rapport, and we quickly changed the script at the last minute. We did a lot of improv stuff. Because they were so comfortable with each other. Mm-hmm. And so it was just guiding that along. I didn't have to tell them, I didn't have to, you know, you just had to keep everybody cheerful, really, and make sure everybody, you know, had cigarettes when they needed it. And
the film is called God Help the Girl. The director is Stuart Murdoch. It's playing here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. It's a terrific new movie, and I encourage all those who get a chance, as the film now heads out into the world, to take a look, and you can take a listen to the music by Bell and Sebastian. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure.
Continuing on the Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center, handing off this interview to my colleague Brian Brooks. I unfortunately have not been able to see this movie, and Brian has and likes it.
I was lucky, yes.
I'm going to hand it off to him, and he will introduce the film and our guest.
I get to take over the helm for this segment and welcome the woman across from me, Desiree Akhavan. I'm pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
She has a terrific film in the next section of Sundance this year called Appropriate Behavior. I accidentally called it Inappropriate Behavior at one point, and maybe that's okay.
But both work. Same difference.
Yes. So this is broadcasting on KCPW in Salt Lake City, and also live stream on iTunes and on our site, filmlink.com. Tell people who are listening in about your film.
So Appropriate Behavior is a feature comedy about a woman who's just had a devastating breakup with her first girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And it's her trying to pick up the pieces of her life and figure out what went wrong while also coming out to her Iranian family as bisexual.
Right. And there's quite the duality, obviously, that's going on, because there are the expectations of her family.
Yeah.
And there's also the expectations that she has for herself. She has kind of this duality, this sort of conflict going on. So maybe talk a little bit about that.
Well, I really wanted to talk about, you know, the contrasting lifestyles or cultures that I had in my own life. My parents are Iranian. Mm-hmm. My whole family is, most of them are in Iran. A lot of them are in New York City, which is where I was raised. Mm-hmm. And I'm Iranian, but I was also raised in America. I was raised on a lot of shitty American television. And I was so heavily influenced by popular culture. When I was a kid, I would walk past a mirror and be shocked that I wasn't blonde with blue eyes. It was like really just took me aback. And everyone I was ever close with, any friend I had, you know, freckles all over her face and blonde hair and super white parents. And it wasn't a huge, you know, issue for me, but I felt that others had expectations for me that I didn't quite match up to, and trying to find my footing in that respect. And then later on, when I fell in love with a woman and came out as bisexual, I had to face a whole slew of other issues that I wanted to explore in the film.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, you of course wrote and direct the film, and you star in it.
Yep.
And you did a terrific job, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
But what was there ever a moment where you thought maybe I shouldn't star in it also? I mean, this is a bit much.
Well, there was a certain point where I just realized I was a horrible attention whore. Mm-hmm. And I think I was trying to pitch the idea over and over again. Mm-hmm. And people were like, wow, are you sure you really want to do all that? Mm-hmm. Can't you just give up the spotlight for one moment? And I said, no, I need the spotlight. No, you know, it was a matter of the story is so personal, and it felt really disingenuous to hire a better looking version of myself to do her best impression of me. I'm a writer director. I'm a storyteller. I am not an actress, but I grew up really wanting to act, and I grew up doing theater and studying acting, and I really loved it. It was a passion of mine. I don't know if I'll do it again, but for this, it was right. And I had just starred in a web series that I co-created. Mm-hmm. And the experience of working that way was becoming really comfortable to me. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a really nice transition to my first feature film. But, you know, right now I'm working on my second, and I will not be acting in it.
Okay, all right. So, and I do want to ask you in a moment about what you do have coming up, but just to talk a little bit more about your character, was it therapeutic actually going through this process of what, you know, somewhat, you know, these parallels between your real life and then your character's life?
Yeah, I think every project I do is usually some form of therapy for me. I like to explore things I'm grappling with and different themes that interest me and that are on my mind. And I always take experiences and then they're no longer real once I make them. You know, this is not an autobiographical film. The anecdotes or the scenes are not stolen from life. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to take these issues and make jokes of them in a way, but also, you know, try to analyze what they were like from a distant perspective. And that does give you a sense of control. Sometimes you feel so victimized by things that happened to you. Mm-hmm. And the minute that you turned it into fiction by dramatizing it, you get you get power over it.
And I did get I was lucky enough to have a little sneak. There was a screening in New York right before Sundance. And you mentioned there that that you had gone to a screening in that very same room that we were at. We were at Technicolor in Greenwich Village. And you mentioned that Iris Sachs had a film at that you had gone to. Mm-hmm. And you have some kind of relationship with him. And he was sort of an inspiration. Of course, he has a film here. And he was on our show, The Daily Buzz, with his film, Love is Strange. That's
so
also premiering here. And yeah, I'm just talk about a little bit about that, like how that sort of was how he kind of motivated you to do this.
Iris Sachs is just a craftsman. He's just so effing talented. I was a graduate student at NYU's film school on the directing program, and he was one of my professors in my third year of classes. And the project for his class was just to make anything, to make a short. And he really inspired us to not be too precious about things. And that was a problem I was having. I was really getting in my own way. And he, you know, he showed this short film he made called Last Address that he shot. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how long, but very quickly with very few resources, and it ended up touring the world. And I was really inspired by that, and I was inspired by his attitude and by his genuine passion for filmmakers established and emerging. So when he made Keep the Lights On, I was actually an extra in it, and when he had his press screening, he invited me to go, and it was one of the most exciting experiences. I went there, and I was like, I can't believe this happened. I remember him talking about wanting to make this, shooting it, and here we are, such a short time later, actually watching it, and it's stunning, and he made everything feel possible. I mean, even though he's had a long career, and he's in a completely different place in his life than me. But when I was making The Slope, he 100% supported me and
your web series,
my web series, and gave me a lot of guidance. And then when I was in prep for this film, he read the script and met with me and gave me all the advice. Mm-hmm. And even when I got into Sundance, he was one of the first people I called.
Celebrated this ride together, or
exactly
at least in conjunction with each other.
But you know, getting into Sundance is also, it opens up a whole world of other issues. You know, you learn in film school maybe how to make a film if you're lucky, but then how to successfully premiere a film is a whole nother game and a very...
Is that a whole other skill set then, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It's a sharp learning curve.
The film is Appropriate Behavior, premiering at the Sundance in the next section. Let's talk really quickly in the 1 minute maybe that we have left, what you have coming up.
So right now I have a web series, an animated web series that I'm doing for a website that Sony is developing called Astronauts Wanted, is the website's name. And then my series for it is called The Origin of Shame. It's about my time at high school in a New York City prep school. And then I also am working on a feature dark comedy, an election-esque comedy. So I guess high school is sort of where I'm at right now.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Looking forward to it. Desiree Akhavan, her film is Appropriate Behavior. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on the Daily Buzz.
Thanks for having me.
And it's the Daily Buzz here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main. Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center sitting here across the table from the directors of The Case Against Eight, Ryan White and Ben Kottner. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having
us.
Thanks,
Eugene.
How are you?
Great. Tired.
That was an emotional and exhilarating and exciting screening earlier this week, your premiere earlier this week at the Sundance Film Festival. I can only imagine how it felt on the other end.
I would say it's an understatement to say we were incredibly overwhelmed by the emotional response.
Yeah.
I think we were inspired by the characters in our film, and we grew to love them over 5 years. But to see audiences respond to that was really special for us.
You rarely see a standing ovation at Sundance that starts during the credits and continues.
I didn't know that.
As the lights are down, that is rare. You see standing ovations, but to have it start during the credits as the room is dark is special, I think.
Yeah, we were pinching ourselves.
The film, The Case Against Eight, is about the case against Proposition 8 in California, the measure that was voted in 2008 by residents of California. And this is the movie follows the case to strike it down.
Mm-hmm.
And the case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. Many people who are listening to the show today know the story, and if you think you know the story, I think the most surprising thing to someone like me who's read all about it and heard all about it and even talked to the two of you about it is that actually the movie is still so much more because of the incredible access that you have. And I think that's what makes the movie even more than just a look at some of the key points in this news story. It's the fact that we get to know the people who were involved in this case and the plaintiffs in the case in such a specific and intimate way. Tell me about gaining that access, Ryan.
Yeah, so we were, Ben and I from the very beginning had said we had never really seen a film that followed a lawsuit, a landmark lawsuit from its infancy all the way through its Supreme Court birth. And so we really wanted to tell a really insider's legal story of that sort of mysterious process of how that works. So there was that one side of our film, and we were very lucky to get access to Ted Olson and David Boyce, who were the opposing attorneys, and Bush v. Gore, who joined forces for this. And
the unlikely attorneys in some ways.
The odd couple. And then on the flip side, as you said, you know, there's the human side of this, of not just our film, but of this issue. And those are four regular Californians. They're two couples who sued the government of California in the federal courts, Chris and Sandy and Paul and Jeff. And they're the real heart of our film, and we're also so lucky that the four of them were willing to let us into their lives in the way that they did, because I think that's where the emotion comes in the film, because you get to watch these two couples go on this journey, and you get to watch what happens to them in the end. And so Ben and I have always said we weren't trying to make a film about whether gay marriage was right or wrong. We were trying to do a character film where you follow these six main characters on their journey and let people watch that journey and decide what they think at the end after you get to see these four couples, or these two couples and four people, get married.
It's interesting to me. I think one of the most profoundly emotional moments of the film, in my opinion, is near the end of the film. We're at the Supreme Court, and the subjects are heading up the stairs into the court. And I don't remember which character it was, but one of them kind of stops on the stairs and turns around and is met with this incredible ovation. And to me, that was a really profoundly moving moment, simply because of everything not only the case had gone through, but the individuals had been through.
Yeah, there were many moments like that for us. not just the ones that made it into the film, but there are many moments like that where you really learn how to hold a camera and cry at the same time. It's sort of there's a tricky art to, like, you know, really being able to do that when you have that much emotion going on. So that was one. There are several like that.
It's interesting to me that you say you wanted to make a film that would examine this issue, no matter your opinion, no matter the viewer's opinion on the matter, that they would have an opportunity to see this case, no matter what they thought. At the same time, the characters in the film talk about feeling this incredible sense of responsibility, because these are the four individuals who are representing so many other people in this landmark case. I couldn't help but wonder, as I was watching, not only because I've known you guys for a while as friends, but because I can't imagine how you felt as filmmakers. You must have felt that same sense of responsibility.
Well, and the lawsuit itself was very controversial at the beginning. It was not popular even within LGBT groups. And so, the four plaintiffs went through the ringer, I know, feeling that burden, but we also did as filmmakers, I think, when people would find out we're making this film, because LGBT groups did not think this was the right strategy at the beginning. It was still a state-by-state strategy, and everyone thought that this was way too soon and too risky and could set the movement back by decades. And so as filmmakers and then as gay people, there's sort of an awkward balance there, because we knew it was an amazing story regardless, but a lot of our gay friends didn't agree with the strategy. I think 5 years later, most people are on board that the case worked. But at the time we were beginning, it wasn't always comfortable.
And there was also the fact that early on, right before the trial started, the Supreme Court blocked the broadcast of the trial. It was supposed to be put out on television, on YouTube. And so once that happened, we were going to make a film regardless. But once that happened, we felt this enormous burden of representing and really telling the story of what happened in that trial, because it's something that the American public should be able to see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me to wonder, and maybe you can share with us how your own views on this strategy changed over the course of the making of the film. What opinions can you say you now had, now that the film is done, 5 years ago, that maybe shifted or changed about this approach and about this strategy? Or did you really not try to think about it that way? I don't know. I'm curious.
I mean, I think that everyone involved in the case knew that there were risks involved in this strategy.
Yeah.
But I think Ted Olson and David Boies, in their great legal might, were very confident that they could win. And regardless, I think they both make the point fairly often that, civil rights battles are won because you fight them. And if, this is what's right. And so the Constitution has said many, many times that marriage is a civil right. The case law was there to support the case. And they had the most amazing team of lawyers to put it on and all of the resources. So I think there are very few opportunities for a trial like this, of this magnitude, to examine the issue in such depth. And I think that they thought that once those issues were put into evidence, and people actually having to show proof and evidence, and one of their lawyers on the other side famously said, when asked by the judge what harm would be done to straight couples if gay marriages were allowed to be married, and his response was, "I don't know."
Mm-hmm.
And then he repeated, "I don't know." So for them, I think it was a combination of those things that, and for us as well, that made us believe that this actually might be a historic case.
And the boldness reaps results. At the beginning of this case, public opinion was heavily against gay marriage. Dick Cheney was the only prominent Republican in favor of gay marriage. Our Democratic president wasn't in favor of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So you can argue that it's too soon, but you see the way the tides have changed in the last 5 years. And I really, truly believe that a lot of that needs to be attached to the Perry case and what it did, and especially the hiring of Ted Olson and taking the political veil away right away and making it a nonpartisan issue and challenging Democrats and Republicans to say, this isn't about politics, this is about human rights, this is about civil rights, where do you stand?
It's an unlikely choice, the selection of Ted Olson as one of the attorneys in this case. You deal with that very early on. And it's a great moment in the film, because it really challenges the viewer and their views on this individual who has been viewed in one particular way because of his involvement in the Bush versus Gore case. What did you think when you first started following
it? Well, it's interesting because we've actually had a lot of people, at least I have, a lot of friends come up and say, oh, do you, before they see the film, they say, do you go into all the horrible things he's done? Like, do you really show that side of it? You really need to, like, show what a bad guy he is. And then they see the film, and they fall in love with him.
Yeah.
It was funny. Morgan Spurlock, we were so happy, saw the film, and it was really sweet of him. He tweeted, hashtag I love Ted Olson.
No one has hugged us more than Ted Olson over the last 5 years, more than our moms. So we really have fallen in love with him too, not just as a character, but as a human being. And I believe
he has
changed.
We still might not agree with him on everything, but we love him as a person.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, but I want to throw in one last question, and that is, from a filmmaking point of view, for filmmakers who might be listening, technology and cameras and camera stock certainly changed a lot over the course of that 5 years. So as a result, we see various sorts of and various types of film.
See, this is why I love these types of interviews. You're the first person to ask us about something like that.
I just want to kind of get your take on that. I mean, you had to really evolve the film with the evolution.
We always
of
joke
technology.
That it was our strategy, that the footage in the beginning would look a lot worse than it was in the end. So it was a creative choice.
I wouldn't say it looked bad, but you certainly see a difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, you filmed something over 5 years and you're broke filmmakers, so you use what you can get. And so the first 2 years of our film were filmed on cameras from my previous films, you know, and then at some point those cameras became outdated. We were actually shooting those on tape, so those tapes would go straight into a safety deposit box because the case was so sensitive. And then at some point we made a little bit of extra money to move up to cameras that shot on drives. And at some point HBO got involved and we were able to hire a legendary editor, so it was sort of an escalation of riches for us.
That's amazing. How many hours of footage did you end up with?
It was somewhere over 600 hours.
Wow. So the post-production process, did you start over the course of production? Or did you wait until, I mean, you must have been,
we really waited because we didn't know how the movie would
end.
We didn't want to start structuring it. So, about 9 months ago, we started logging all of the 600 hours of footage. And then about 6 months ago, we started actually editing the film. So it was an incredibly fast process.
It's amazing to think about, and we'll never know what the film might have been had the case gone a different way. Luckily, we don't need to imagine that. But I'm sure you imagined every possible outcome and thought about various ways you might continue the film. Or, as Ryan, you just said, whether you even had a film, depending on what happened, right?
That would have been the worst thing in the world. If the Supreme Court hadn't taken the case, I think that would have been the most devastating, because that was always the dream third act for a film, right? To take it to the Supreme Court. And then to win, yeah. But we talked about what it would be like to lose, too, and I think that would be a completely different film, but also probably equally emotional and probably an amazing story as well, and a real call to action. And,
mm-hmm. and people are still there. Their stories are still real.
Yeah. I mean, and it's still happening nationwide. There's people going through those stories in other ways. We got to premiere our film in Utah, which is so amazing, and the couples in Utah are going through the same thing that the couples in California went through 5 years ago. Yeah. So it's sort of a national story of relevance right now.
The film is The Case Against 8. The filmmakers are Ryan White and Ben Kottner. Thank you for spending time with us on The Daily Buzz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's The Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. On a rare remote interview, we're here at the Prospector Square, backstage talking with the filmmaker, director of Song One, Kate Barker Froilan. Welcome.
Thank you, Eugene.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So your film is off and running here at Sundance. We're going to dive right in because we have a limited window of time to talk to you. The first thing I want to ask you about is, I was thinking about this morning as I was heading over to this interview, the endurance test it must be to make a feature. You've certainly worked in the short form, and making the leap to a feature film, to what extent is that an endurance test, or to what extent was that challenging? How did you sort of manage that move from short film to feature film?
Yeah, it definitely is an endurance test, I think, because for my short films, you know, it took less time to develop them. With this feature, it took around 5 years, just from start to finish, and we just finished the film last week, actually. There are a lot of similarities in a way. It's just, but there are a lot more steps in the process. Right. And I also did a lot more rewriting of this this script than my short films.
Well, for those who are listening in here on KCPW, we'll have a chance to see the film this week at the festival, but also for those who are listening outside of Park City around the country, I want to describe the film a little bit and then have you talk about sort of where the idea came from. In the film, set in and around essentially Brooklyn and New York, there's a woman whose brother is recovering from, or in the hospital from, an injury, a serious injury. And over the course of the film, she gets to know this musician who her brother is a big fan of, and a relationship blossoms. But it's set in a world of New York that is populated by really cool artists and music, and she and the musician are weaving in and out of clubs and watching really cool artists, and it's a really touching story, but I'm wondering where the sort of original idea for it came from. Was it really from the music? Was it from the relationship? Was it from the family dynamic, this woman and her mom and her brother who's been injured? Where did it start?
Well, it really started with, I had the idea of these three characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Franny and James, who's the musician, and Franny's younger brother, Henry, who's an aspiring musician. Mm-hmm. And I really loved it. It's sort of both. It's these characters and the music that mm-hmm. were the origin of the story, because I loved the idea of a song connecting them all mm-hmm. and music connecting them all. And they're all very distinct and kind of in their own worlds, you know? So I just started writing more about these characters and thinking more about them. And also the fact that Franny and James would never normally meet. And it's really music. It's Henry's song that brings them together. And James's music, too. Yeah. So it's kind of all of those things mm-hmm. that got me started writing the story.
I want to talk about the actors you worked with in a moment, but first let's talk about the music. There's a number of original songs, original pieces that are in the film. Tell me about how you went about finding that music, finding the musicians who would write those songs, and the songs are so crucial to the story. What the songs say are so crucial to what the movie says and what these characters are thinking. So tell me about the process of finding that music, finding the musicians.
Yeah, so Jenny Lewis and Jonathan Rice wrote all of James and Henry's songs. Mm-hmm. And I met them, you know, about a year and a half ago. And they were friends of Annie and Adams, who are producers on the film, and Annie is in the film. And we met in LA, and we talked. They had read the script, and we talked a lot about James's backstory. And then the next day, I got on my plane to go home to New York, and I found a song that they had written as, you know, their idea of a James song called Little Yellow Dress, which is in the film now. And I just I loved it, and I thought the lyrics were amazing. And so that was the beginning of our collaboration. Mm-hmm. And basically they, you know, the songs are really James's narrative. They contain James's narrative mm-hmm. within them. It's really, he's poured everything mm-hmm. of himself into this one album mm-hmm. that has become a success. And so the songs really are integral to the whole film and tell their own story. So we talked a lot. I talked a lot with Jenny and Johnny about James's character and that's how the songs developed over time.
You work with a high-profile actress. Anne Hathaway plays the main character of Franny in the film. Tell me about how the two of you connected and why she was the right person to play this role.
Yeah. So I had met Annie on Devil Wears Prada because I was the director's assistant. Mm-hmm. And then Jonathan Demme, who's a producer on this film, he knew that Adam and Annie were interested in producing, so he sent them the script, and he kind of reconnected us. And Annie just really loved the part of Franny, and so asked to play Franny or be considered for the part. And so it was really cool because I had basically a year and a half to kind of develop the part more with her, and in my rewriting, I wrote it, you know, with her specifically in mind.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to just talk about the casting of some of the other key roles very briefly.
tell me about how you found some of the other key actors. Mary Steenburgen plays Franny's mom. There's a number of other great actors, and I'm forgetting the name of the actor who plays. Tell me about Johnny Flynn.
Yeah, so Johnny Flynn, I had seen this French film called Goodbye First Love at the New York Film Festival, and in I think it was 2011, and the last song of that film is this song that's gorgeous. Yeah. And I had sort of, I watched the film, I heard the song, and I sort of, you know, left the theater with this song in my head, but sort of forgot about it. And then later, I just happened, while we were casting James, I just happened to see a trailer online of the film, and that song was there again. So I was like, I need to find out who wrote this song. So I started Googling, and I found out it was Johnny Flynn. And I also found out that he was an actor, a classically trained actor, and he was doing Twelfth Night at the Globe Theater in London. So that was the beginning of it, you know? And so we flew to London and watched him in this play, and he read for the part, and he was amazing. Yeah, and Mary Steenburgen, she read the script, and she really connected with the part, and she's like, she was a dream. I mean, that was a dream for me. Yeah. To be able to cast her.
The film is called Song One. We've been speaking with Kate Barker Froiland here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. We're backstage at the Prospector Theater where her film is currently screening, and you're about to head in and do a Q&A. We're about to head back to Main Street to do some more interviews. So we'll pick up the conversation the next time we see you. Thank you for spending time with us. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Continuing on the Daily Buzz, Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center here at the 1 million square foot lounge on Main Street. Guest is Mark Rasso. Welcome.
Thank you, Eugene.
The film is Copenhagen. Congratulations on having the movie at Slam Dance.
Thanks so much.
Tell us about the movie.
Copenhagen's a love story about an American kind of scoundrel character who goes to Denmark to find his last living relative, a strange grandfather. Mm-hmm. And on his journey, he meets a young Danish woman, falls in love. The film takes place over a 24 to 36 hour period, yeah. A magical night in Copenhagen. And, yeah. You know, beyond the kind of typical love story, traveling love story, it's really more about growing up, finding your past, and also shedding the weight of and the burdens of your family's history and past.
Well, it's in the title of the film, so I want to ask, why Copenhagen?
I had lived there in 2006 before I went to Columbia University, and I lived there for a year, and I got the idea of the story there. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful city, magical. The energy of the city is so wonderful that I thought it needed to be captured on film. And then I wrote it when I went to Columbia.
It's a city I've always wanted to check out. I've been to a bunch of other European cities. That's one that's been high on my list. Tell me about what in particular about Copenhagen as a city was inspirational to you, or what did it, you know, what did it sort of spark in you creatively?
The youthfulness of the city. Yeah. I mean, there's young people, and I'm talking like 14, 15, 16 year old, right. Who kind of like have a hold of the city. You find them out at bars and clubs. It's very different than here. Mm-hmm. The bicycles, everyone's on a bicycle all the time. And you go there, you get your bike and you feel a part of it. And then, especially in the summertime, it's like, you know, the sun sets around midnight and it comes up at 4 a.m. and it's just
so much
bright.
Light.
Yeah, it's so much light. There's so much energy.
Tell me about shooting the movie. Tell me about where and how you shot. Obviously, it's an independent production.
Yeah. Extremely independent production.
Let's hear about it.
Well, I was at my last year at Columbia when I decided to do it. And we started with about $30,000. All I had was a script. And then we're planning to do it the summer after I graduated. I was fortunate enough about 6 weeks before we landed in Copenhagen, but 6 weeks before production, I won the Student Academy Award with my short film.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So after that, people became interested
that
a little bit more.
Little bit.
It changed. Our budget went up, sponsorship went up. Yeah. People's interest in the film went up, but we basically landed there with six people from school and a script 6 weeks before production, and we put it all together really quickly, and we had incredible support from the Danish film community.
It's hard enough to make an independent film in this country. I can't imagine transporting yourself and your crew to a whole different country and trying to immerse yourself. I mean, you'd obviously spend time there, but that's got to be another hurdle, another challenge.
It was extremely challenging. The one thing that was kind of very interesting was that what we were doing wasn't very common there. They have film schools and everything kind of runs through their government funding or Nordisk Films. And so we were kind of bringing this like New York indie filmmaking attitude and we found people were getting really, really excited about it.
Oh, really?
Because it wasn't common. Like, they just didn't really do that. So in the end, it was really like, I don't think we could have accomplished what we did there, even though it's one of the most expensive countries in Europe. And our money was really, really stretched. But just the level of enthusiasm was beyond belief, really.
Well, in the moment that we have left, tell us what you're working on next.
I have a few things going on. There's a script that won the Academy's Nickel Fellowship.
Congratulations.
I actually didn't write it, but I know the writer and I attached myself. And
oh, great.
We've been working on it and we're going out to some pretty good cast right now and hoping
What's
that... It's about a female, 45-year-old female assassin who goes home for the first time in 25 years to find her mother dying, estranged mother dying, and her mother asks her to euthanize her while she's there. So it's really it's dark, it's gritty.
The title?
Killers.
Killers. All right, well, that film is Killers. This film is Copenhagen, playing at the Slam Dance Film Festival just up the street here on Main Street. Catch it this week. Our guest has been Mark Grasso. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eugene.
And as we continue on the Daily Buzz here at the 1 million square foot lounge, Main Street, sitting across the table from Kara Mertes, welcome.
Hello.
And you're at the Ford Foundation.
I am.
You have a long history with Sundance, so it's nice to. I'm sure it's nice to come home.
It is nice to come home.
Tell us about your new role at the Ford Foundation.
Well, it's a thrilling role, and actually coming back to Sundance after 7 years of being here as part of the documentary film program and fund director is a really fascinating experience. And I've been brought over to the Ford Foundation to become the grantor of my old program, but also many other programs globally. So I have a $10 million portfolio and a new president, Darren Walker, who really loves culture and understands art and culture as something that is very fundamental to the search for social justice across the globe. And so that is the mandate.
Ford's film program, film initiatives are illustrious, important, the films that Ford funds and backs and supports are, you know, the list is awesome. Tell us about some of the films recently so that folks have a reference point for the kind of work that Ford backed and,
absolutely.
And funds.
We've had a number of films in every Sundance since Just Films was started 3 years ago. And this year we have five films that are here. And as I've come into this job, one of the things that I focused on doing is broadening out our focus on not just the films that we fund. And so, for instance, we have Caesar's Last Fest here and The E-Team and Through a Lens Darkly and Marmato and We Are the Giant. Those are the five films that Just Films supported last year and in years previous that are premiering. But as importantly, because we have this global mandate about growing the field of creativity in this storytelling space, we also have partners. Our major partners are Sundance Institute, Tribeca, Film Institute, and ITVS. And so one of the things that I want to do is bring a real emphasis to the importance of the infrastructure of the world of the creative storyteller. Because when we support those organizations and they support filmmakers and stakeholders, what we begin to see is a real center of power in terms of how we can raise up these stories in the world as we're working on, you know, finding greater equality, lessening some of the disenfranchisement that we see, reducing poverty, some of the big issues that Ford is thinking about. But we can do it using narrative.
The folks listening to this show on KCPW or listening around the country, I'm sure some of them, or maybe many of them, are filmmakers. And Ford being one of the most coveted funders and supporters, tell some of the creative community who might be listening a bit about how they can tap into, connect with, become more aware of some of the opportunities that might be out there for their projects.
Well, the first answer is the website, and especially because we're global, the website is very important for us in terms of getting information out about what we're doing and where we're doing it. Mm-hmm. Ford Foundation typically has a very small team. Our job is to fund, is to get the money from where, you know, we hold it to the people that will make the change that we're seeking. Mm-hmm. So we do take applications. We're probably going to shift how we do that directly to Ford and make it a request process. And we have Tribeca and Sundance specifically as organizations that we fund with granting funding.
Each of those has a mechanism.
Yes, we use them, and they have much larger staffs. For instance, the staff that I built at Sundance is 13 people with an army of pre-screeners. We simply don't have that at Ford Foundation. But Sundance does. And so we'll very likely have people apply to our partners who specifically have money to re-grant. Yeah. Tribeca Film Institute, we're using our relationship with them and the brilliant people that are working there to understand the digital storytelling space.
Right.
And they have an equal amount of funding as Sundance does. So we're looking for both experimentation in storytelling as well as holding down the fort in a way on long-form cinematic storytelling, which of course is the heartbeat of what Sundance has always been and will be, you know, for the foreseeable future, we hope.
Our guest is Kara Mertes from the Ford Foundation. As we wrap up, one more question. How does the funding that you're doing on the film side or the work you're doing with other institutions on the film side interlock or connect with the other initiatives of the Ford Foundation? Can you tell us about how any connections may happen outside of just film and how you connect them to the other parts of the organization?
That's a wonderful question. One of the things that we've done this year is continued in the tradition that Orlando Bagwell, who was my predecessor, wonderful filmmaker, really built the template for this program, and I've been able to walk into that vision. And one of the things that he did is he brought program officers here. And what I've done is selected program officers from the Ford Foundation who have portfolios that are social justice oriented but may or may not have film in their portfolio or the idea of film and digital storytelling. And so I'm bringing them to films and to New Frontier and to The Source and showing them ways that creativity can work for them in ways that they might not ever have imagined. So part of that is educating people into this space, and likewise they're educating me into their spaces. So that I can begin to understand how this very powerful thing that we all live in, which is creativity, can be used for the greater good that Ford Foundation and many, many of us are seeking.
Kara Mertes from the Ford Foundation, thank you for spending time with us on The Daily Buzz.
Thank you.
Have a good festival.
Thanks.
Wrapping up this Thursday edition, Thursday, January 23rd edition, Day 8 at Sundance 2014. I want to thank our sponsors and supporters. We've recorded the show this week at Microsoft's Million Square Foot Lounge on Main Street, as well as the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main. I want to thank our sponsors, Soyombo, Sabra, Skull Candy, and Cloud Electronics, as well as our in-kind supporters, All Good Provisions, Super Good Bars, and People Water. On tomorrow's edition, we'll meet the filmmakers of 20 Days on Earth, and we're also going to present highlights from the past week, some of our favorite interviews here at the Sundance Film Festival. It's The Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, filmlink.com, and on iTunes. Our producer is Irene Cho. See you tomorrow.